I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, and welcome to episode 051 of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. The title of today's episode is Cellular Ecology, Guerrilla Organizations, and Grunt Math. Now, in this episode, what we're going to be examining is how guerrilla organizations, irregular warfare organizations, terrorist organizations hide, and what nation states and non-nation state entities do to find them, compete, unearth them, neutralize them, whatever the case may be. You will note in the show notes that I have included links to PDFs that are far too great for me to really elucidate on air in any lengthy fashion that wouldn't make this particular episode hours long. Among those will be the Irish Republican Army Green Book, the Al-Qaeda book that they use that was discovered approximately 140 pages, some interesting articles that I found to include Lizard Farmer's 2013 piece on how they hunt, and Modeling Terrorist Networks, which I found, which is very interesting. Now, of course, what we're going to be discussing here is controversial to some and not controversial to others. Your mileage may vary. A little bit of housekeeping. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can go to my Substack page, which you'll find in the show notes for this episode, in whatever podcast vendor you happen to be using, and I thank you for your solicitude and listenership. You can email me directly at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. That email will also be in either the Substack or show notes. The Substack show notes and the show notes that you will find on your podcast vendor that RSS feeds. Per episode 50, when I talked about tactics, techniques, and procedures that one can take up on their own to protect you from what my perennial listeners have seen in the Storming America series I did, which has expanded to almost six parts to include the last two ancillary parts where I talk about what individuals, friends, families, and neighbors can do on their own to protect you from what I think is the inevitable, upscaled, spontaneous, complex attack that will take part in the American heartland. During that podcast, I spoke, this is episode 50, I spoke to Body Armor. I wanted to caution everybody, if you happen upon Body Armor that's cheaper than usual, always scratch your head and ask yourself, is the price giving me an indication of the validity and provenance of the armor that I'm getting? So my youngest son, who is a fellow kit hound and geardo like myself, urged me to sort of put out a consumer warning message concerning steel plates. Those of you who are looking for body armor and you want to do it on the cheap, or you happen to be frugal and you don't have a lot of money to spend on it, well, find steel armor out there. And that steel armor can be level 3 or level 4. I would urge all of you to research it appropriately and find out what is best for you. You have to ensure, if you get steel plates, you must coat them to keep a phenomenon called spalling from affecting you, and that is this. If a round or a number of rounds impacts that steel plate, physics tells you that if that round stops there, doesn't penetrate the plate, all of that energy is distributed elsewhere, to include shearing off parts of said plate and parking some of it in parts of your body, to include your chin. Very unpleasant, because I've seen it happen once and I would not recommend it for anybody. So that's a cautionary tale that I wanted to put out there. I've had a number of listeners reach out to me and ask me questions about that two-part addendum I made to the Storming America series, where I tried to personalize and make recommendations on what one can do to secure your friends, family, and neighbors and yourself from harm if this inevitable thing happens. So please continue to send those in. I'm happy to oblige and address those, and I thank you for your listenership. So let's get on with this podcast episode 051. What we're talking about here is the cell structures, the clandestine cell structures and systems that are used by guerrilla and insurgent organizations in order to survive in a contested and non-permissive environment in which they are trying to advance their particular martial and insurgency agenda. Now, I've mentioned before in podcasts, but I'll mention it again now, there is a bifurcation between clandestine and covert. Clandestine is a black-to-black operation. Covert is an operation, take the T off, you'll remember it this way, in which one assumes a cover. So in the West, when organizations such as the three-letter agencies send their intelligence operatives across the span of whatever those intelligence operatives happen to do, will find themselves at an embassy or a consulate acting as an agricultural attaché or military attaché, when in essence, maybe as a secondary job or a cover for their primary position, they are an intelligence operative. So that's the distinction between covert and clandestine. Covert, when it comes to this, there's a number of things. The modern NATO definition of a covert operation says the identity of the sponsor is concealed, but in a clandestine operation, the operation itself is concealed from the participants. Now, that's stretching it a bit because that's not always the case. We're also going to be talking about sleeper cells and isolated grouping of sleeper agents that lie dormant and why that cellular structure is so important for them to have success. And keep in mind, these are organizational structures that are set up to advance the agenda of what may be an either concealed or overt political action wing. For instance, when you look at the Irish Republican Army, for the longest time, they had a separate cutout with the Sinn Féin organization, which from the beginning of the 20th century through today, and of course through the Accords, that stopped most of the IRA mischief in Northern Ireland and parts of the UK with the Good Friday Accords. Now, mind you, what you have today, for instance, with some of the unpleasantness that's going on in Southern Ireland, known as AIRE, E-I-R-E, my apologies to my Gaelic linguists out there, I will probably butcher and torture the articulation and pronunciation of Gaelic words on occasion. But what you find is that they separated them so that they could have a two-front organizational combat with the UK at the time, in which they would use political means that would be backstopped or augmented by the militia or military means in the IRA. Now, of course, we can go to another example, and that would be this. We've all heard of the French Resistance in World War II. Essentially, there were a number of organizations, but the two primary organizations were the French Resistance, one could put that in air quotes, and the Maquis. Both of these happened to have survived almost 6 years under Nazi occupation with occupied France because, I would suggest, they were communists before the war, they continued to be communists during the war, and of course after the war, we know that they all continued to be communists. By the way, one can say the same thing about the IRA. The IRA, for the most part, especially after World War II, became a rock-solid Marxist-Leninist organization with very few splinter organizations because there were a variety of the real IRA, the provisional IRA, and other organizations that quite literally splintered off. But most of them would heel and obey the Marxist-Leninist communist, hard socialist baselines that were set out for them by Sinn Féin and others. So going back to World War II in Vichy France and the French Resistance there, the only reason, and they were counter-bandit operations for the Nazis instead of counter-insurgency, it's just the term of art that the Wehrmacht and the SS employed, was that they used that cellular organization to establish their teams beforehand And because of that cellular organization, fighting against the pre-Vichy French government and concealing themselves as communist insurgents in France proper to include its colonies, they found that this was extraordinarily useful to evade, mostly successfully with some landmark failures, evade the very rabid and pretty profound National Socialist attempts to subvert them and neutralize them and liquidate them. But because of that cellular structure, they were able to continue to operate. So basically, these clandestine cell systems, these structures, it's a way to organize so that you can avoid exposure to those elements in the society in which you are swimming and operating from taking out your organization. In the cell structure, each cell consists of a relatively small number of people who know little to no information concerning organization assets outside what they're doing within their cell. And this limits the harm that could be done to the organization if some or many of them are rolled up, or if some of them are defecting, or some of them are moles. They know that they're being surveilled. They've conducted the sous-surveillance, which is counter-surveillance activities to ensure that that doesn't happen. This structure of those clandestine cell systems can range from a strict hierarchy to an extraordinarily distributed organization, depending on the group's ideology. And what you find is that while I really don't like using left-right as a paradigm, because I think it's fabulism for the most part, because you're either an individualist or a collectivist in the political spectrum. But nonetheless, I will suspend my disbelief and employ the coda of left and right, because I think that most of my audience and most folks in the West are comfortable with what that demarcation is. What you find is that, as I mentioned, depending on the group's ideology, the more left, the more communist, the more socialist, the more successful these organizations are at maintaining their cellular structures and conducting their operations. One would be hard-pressed to find right-of-center organizations in Western history that have succeeded with mass cells of folks who were able to operate in what Mao would characterize as the sea of the population, unfettered and without having their operational freedom compromised. I did want to mention what I've always found extraordinary, and I guess that you'll find this throughout military history, is that here we have the communist ideology, which motivated a very disciplined and formidable cellular structure for the French Resistance and the Maquis prior to World War II. Yet after World War II, as I've talked about in some of my very earliest episodes, when I talked about the French in Indochina in the 40s and 50s, and the French in Algeria in the 40s and 50s, here we have the liberation of France, kicking out the Germans as an occupation force in Vichy France, and then, of course, doubling down on these colonial holdings in Indochina, in Algeria, respectively, and then almost erasing their entire memory of how cellular organizations conduct themselves, how guerrilla operations are put to good use, and the effectiveness of underground organizations and how one can exploit them, since they had acted as that for almost 6 years in Vichy France. It's almost that entire institutional martial memory of how that was done was forgotten, leading to the losses to the French colonial empire of both Indochina and Algeria out of metropolitan France. There are a number of factors that I'm going to delineate that can actually be a part of all cellular structures or not be, by exception. You will find, for instance, that while the Provisional Irish Republican Army had a history going back to revolutionary forces in the early 20th century, they started to change as a result of how their modeling and the Marxist-Leninist influence on what they were doing. For instance, I talked about that dual but sometimes overlapping party and military structure that was top-down, where you have Sinn Féin and you have the IRA. The lowest level Cells, typically of 2 to 5 people, tended to be built from people with existing personal relationships. Those best relationships would be entire families comprised of brothers and sisters, where for the most part, the authorities that were going after these folks and hunting them would find them the hardest to exploit and fold up. Now, parallel organizations and shadow governments are always important in this. What I mean by parallel organizations are these are underground organizations that are running in a fashion so that they can leverage both political and military opportunities. And sometimes, as Hamas and Hezbollah has demonstrated, actual economic opportunities by providing parallel structures in the society that convince that very society of the legitimacy of the organization because they're how they're helping them in their everyday lives. Here we are on the 51st episode, and I want to remind you of those three pillars that I always try to press home on what makes for a successful insurgency, and that is legitimacy, grievances, real or perceived, and narrative. If those three things are mastered, there's a very good chance that that insurgency will succeed. These parallel organizations, these shadow governments, they do have splits in them from the secret organizations, but nonetheless, in these active insurgencies, that secrecy could limit freedom of action. It could distort information about goals and ideals, which is why you find a lot of them making a bifurcation, in this case, Sinn Féin and the IRA, on what they're doing. Because like modern, larger nation states, all diplomacy that takes place in the admittedly anarchic nature and ecology of international relationships is usually backed up by one form of force or another. For the most part, external support is vital for these. The U.S. and the West provided Jedburgh teams and other modalities to the Maquis and the French Resistance during World War II, parachuting in supplies, providing training, bringing people out to train and return, native speakers, all of those kind of things. When you look at the cell systems for Afghanistan, for instance, and Al-Qaeda, there was a very large external support network for them that did two things in the physical and not-so-physical realm. In the physical realm, it provided them with a means, for instance, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where if things got too hot on the Afghan side of the border, the usual suspects would retreat across the Pakistani border into a relatively not-so-hostile state where they could recover and then, of course, train for future operations. Now, I'm going to try to paint a picture of how some of the cellular structures differ from one another. I'm going to draw from FM3-07, which was the Stability Operations and Support Operations field manual that was put out by the U.S. Army in 2007, I think that it was, the same year that the counterinsurgency manual, actually the year prior in 2006, is when FM3-24, the counterinsurgency manual, was put out. I will treat that counterinsurgency manual in the future because I think it deserves broader discussion, because I think a large part of the problems in Afghanistan stem from embracing a lot of the just absolutely numbskulled policies and conclusions that particular book came out with. Of course, embracing in this case the idea that the Western countries could succeed at counterinsurgency. And I think that I've made it a fair point consistently throughout my episodes that that is not only improbable, but most likely impossible. Nyberg talked about this, and I think that these distinctions that he makes are really useful. So in this case, I want to make sure that Nyberg gets the appropriate hat tip to having provided these. He was a USMC officer. He describes 4 types of cell systems. One of them is traditional. It is the slowest to form. These are typically indigenous insurgencies that begin with limited goals. These are more secure than others, as they tend to form from people with pre-existing social, cultural, and family ties. I would say, I'm quoting here from him, that those family ties are the most important for trying to make those really bulletproof as far as being penetrated by external agencies, nation states, or others who are trying to counter what that cell structure is trying to accomplish. The Mujahideen in Afghanistan and the Kurdish revolt in Iraq in the 1990s, and it continues to this day, are examples of this traditional pattern of insurgency. Al-Qaeda generally operates in this mode, but if they become strong enough in a given area, they may change to a more mass-oriented form, which we're going to talk about as the fourth item here. The second of these is subversive. These are usually driven by an organization that contains at least some of the governing elite, some being sympathizers already in government and others who penetrate the government. When they use violence, it has a specific purpose, such as coercing voters, intimidating officials, and disrupting and discrediting the government. Now, by the way, these can be spontaneous also and planned with less overt reasons to topple an existing government. For instance, if we look in the early 20th century at Gandhi's Satyagraha campaigns, where he led protests in which they would not respond to violence, but they would have these massive protests that, from the optics position, really look bad for the countries that would react to these in a violent fashion. When I've talked about Michael Collins in the past, who was the intelligence operative working with Eamon de Valera in the 1916 to 1922 Irish Civil War, what he did, I think, to a certain extent, was exploit what had happened in the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in India in 1919 and 1920 by shining a light on what had happened when the British Army opened fire on unarmed protesters and the resulting kerfuffle leading to what I've mentioned before is Churchill's greatest speech, which is his Amritsar speech that he did in 19 or 21. So nonetheless, what you find with these subversive organizations is that they can go across the entire span of violence. I had just mentioned what happened with Collins exploiting what had happened in India to Great Britain to influence what would happen to Great Britain in Ireland. And then the same thing almost occurs when one looks at notions of Irish democracy, which is a term which means that either one doesn't comply with government edicts or you over-comply with government edicts to clog up a given system. In this case, one would find that in third world countries where taxation is just absolutely appalling and the population for the most part is incapable of paying it, they simply don't pay it. I remember going to the Philippines, and it was really interesting on several occasions where they had this road in which one was forced to stop or you were fined. Nobody stopped. We'd stop at local vendors, and they had to take taxes from you, even though for the most part they wouldn't, thank goodness, because of a memo that was on the glass of their cart or their shop that said you had to pay the following taxes to do such and such. Well, they posed the memo, but they didn't enforce it. Those are forms of Irish democracy. Now, what we find, for instance, switching to France in World War II, when it comes to subversive cell structures, the Nazi rise to power in the 30s is another example of subversion. Nazi members of parliament and street fighters were hardly clandestine, but the overall plan of the Nazi leadership to gain control of the nation was hidden. But of course, in 1933 to 1934, we see exactly what happened, because a subversive insurgency is suited to a more permissive political environment, which allows the insurgents to use both legal and illegal methods to accomplish their goals. Of course, what we have is we have Western intelligence agencies and a lot of U.S. intelligence agencies using these means to conduct what we would call and characterize as domestic color revolutions, where they use what is ostensibly legal methodologies to suborn or subvert existing systems. Voting would be one of those. 1984 to 1986 was probably maybe the modern birthplace of color revolutions. But I'm willing for my listeners to let me know how maybe in the banana wars of the early 20th century, maybe going back into the 19th century, where intelligence organizations in the West use voting and the franchise in countries overseas, because we saw it as recently as what happened in Ukraine in 2008 and 2014 with the Maidan Revolution, and then, of course, what the mischief that's been conducted in Israeli elections when it comes to that kind of thing. And what it is it's a form of national power projection from the U.S. in the West to warp and refashion election results to put the people in power that the West desires. So, again, that would be traditional and subversive. And then we have something called critical cell. Now, these come into play when the political climate becomes less permissive than one that allowed the shadow cells. When other cell systems try to form intelligence cells within the government, this type sets up shadow government cells, as we saw from 1916 to 1922 in Irish government in the southern counties. This model includes a classic coup d'etat and often tries to minimize violence. Examples of this could include what happened in Nicaragua with the Sandinista takeover of the existing government that was so weakened by external popular revolution. And by the way, when you look at that particular revolution, if it weren't for the Gulf of Fonseca and the ability to have sequestered safe havens in other places in El Salvador and other countries, they couldn't have made this work as well as they did. These clandestine cells form inside the government. The use of violence remains covert until the government is so weakened that the insurgency's superior organization seizes power, supported by the armed forces. And one variation of this pattern is where the insurgent leadership permits the popular revolution to destroy the existing government that emerges to direct the formation of a new government. Another variation of this is seen in the Cuban Revolution. It's referred to as the FOCO, or the Cuban model insurgency. This model involves a single-armed cell which emerges in the midst of a degenerating government legitimacy and becomes a nucleus around which mass popular support rallies. Again, when they use this term, this phraseology of mass popular support, that's going to be those three layers that I was talking, those three pillars that I was talking about, which is going to be legitimacy, narrative, and grievances. If all of those can be fulfilled, and fulfilled in the fashion in which it is transmitted to the mass base, where they actually believe it to be the better and more correct narrative than that of the existing government, that government will fall. And then finally, we have the mass-oriented. Now, while the subversive and covert cell systems work from within the government, the mass-oriented system builds a government completely outside the existing one with the intention of replacing it. Such insurgents patiently construct a base of passive and active political supporters. You'll find that when you look at the People's Republic of China, the first American Revolution from 1775 till 1783, and the Shining Path insurgency in Peru, these are examples of the mass-oriented model with some exceptions there. I also wanted to call out that, and we're going to talk about this a little later in the episode, that when you look at the American Revolution, the first one in the 18th century, there were a variety of what were called committees of correspondence and insurgent cells alive and well throughout British North America. Now, most of these were the result of the Cousins War, the French and Indians War, what one can probably suggest was the first actual world war on Earth since the formation of Western civilizations, that ended in 1765 with the Spanish and French accepting Canada, tossed out of North America for the most part. Now, there, while the French and Spanish influence waned, the French and Spanish were in collusion with the committees of correspondence and other subversive and sabotage organizations that were there to get the British out of North America and make London abandon their colonies on the Atlantic seaboard. And they spent years putting everything in place to make that happen. Hence, that's why I would call it a mass-oriented model. Now, there's going to be classic models for these cell system operations. And what you'll find, for instance, is you'll have operations under official cover, which will be those covert organizations I talked about, and the covert participants. Like one of my listeners would actually be an intelligence operative, but would go into country A or B to be the cultural attaché, even though he's actually there as an intelligence operative. Hence, he is cover. Now, clandestine presence, as I talked about, was a black-to-black entity in which it is concealed on what its nature is from the beginning left of bang through the operation itself and then post-operation. Now, you'll also have what's referred to as fault-tolerant cellular structures. And modern communications theories introduce methods to increase fault tolerance in cell organizations. Now, game theory and graph theory, they've been applied to the study of optimal covert network design. You will find, for instance, that with these kind of things, everyday commercial entities employ these, such as what Apple does to make your systems more secure, to use scrambling, to use modalities that enable them not to be monitored and such. Now, in the past, if cell members only knew the cell leader and the leader was neutralized, the cell was cut off from the rest of the organization. But if a traditional cell had independent communications with a foreign support entity, then they might be able to arrange its reconnection. And another method is to have impersonal communications as side links. Most of these would be characterized by runners or dead drops. These links, to be used only on losing contact, they don't guarantee a contact. What happens for the most part, and I can especially say this in retrospect, when you looked at Paul Revere and other intelligence entities, and one could characterize him as an intelligence entity. I would urge you to read Paul Revere's Ride by David Hackett Fisher to see how deeply imbued he was in these various intelligence and underground structures that were present from about, I would say, 1765 through 1783 with the final conquest and divorce of London from the Atlantic seaboard in America and the consequent emerging of the American state. They speculated that he was a member of 20-some-odd committees of correspondence, but a cautionary note here is this, is that if they had had the intelligence capabilities today that could somehow magically be transported back then, especially when it comes to communications monitoring and surveillance, Paul Revere and all of those committees of correspondence would have been rolled up by the English in just a matter of weeks, if not months. And because they didn't have the technology then that they have now, they were able to successfully wrest their independence from London. But on reflection, if they had had communications as they have today and these larger Western organizations, three-letter agencies and such, can monitor those and put together what's referred to as association matrices, where they connect the dots on who knows each other and communicates with each other, they could roll these up. If you look in the 1950s and 60s, for instance, when you look at the French in Algeria, and I think they did this to a lesser extent in Indochina, you would see them writing on chalkboards and what we would use as whiteboards today, and start connecting the dots on who's talking to who, and with that, they could instantiate these association matrices, especially if who was talking to who talked between each other more often than not. That would establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were in touch with each other and provide the means to roll these cells up. So I'd mentioned to you that the Al-Qaeda training manual, that 140-page PDF that I'm going to put in the show notes that you can read at your leisure, if it's authentic, it demonstrates that the Eastern cell structures may differ from the Western mode. Al-Qaeda's minimum Minimal Core Leadership Group can be viewed as a ring or chain network, almost Bitcoin-ish, with each leader node heading their own particular hierarchy. Now, such networks, by having their sub-networks provide information and other forms of support, while the core group supplies truth and decisions directions, this is the one-to-many model, that trust and personal relationships are an essential part of the Al-Qaeda network. One thing I want to take a note of here, and that's this. They call it the Al-Qaeda network, and one can say that Osama bin Laden and Al-Ziri were certainly the top dogs in this organization for the longest time until they both assumed room temperature. But, and this was brought to my attention in a book that I read by a former colleague of mine, Lieutenant General Daniel Bulger. That book is Why We Lost, A General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. And I know that listeners who may have listened to all or most of my podcasts know that I hold the current flag officer compliment throughout all the Western militaries in very low order. Bulger would be an exception to that rule. He and I served together in the 101st. I had the opportunity to meet with him briefly while I was in Afghanistan as a contractor. Just a solid stud of a guy and an intellectual of the highest order, and really knew his way around putting together all the parts and pieces looking backwards of the historical baseline of why the cause and effect happened in the first place. He brings up very interesting points. I urge you to read the book if you get an opportunity. Very interesting points about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden had been a contractor. In this sense, not a contractor as a hired gun in Afghanistan or such, but a genuine contractor in civil engineering and such. Because of his civil engineering and the concomitant expertise in taking all of these systems of systems elements and putting them together to build a building or a series of buildings or a complex of arterials leading to said buildings, it gave him, I think, a unique background to plot what would become his signature models of terrorism. In this case, simultaneous attacks on American embassies in 1998, the attack on the coal using some very savvy knowledge about how the coal refuels and refits when it was in the Gulf of Aden, and of course we have the simultaneous strikes on September 11th, 2001, simultaneous strikes that not only happened almost without a hitch, excepting Flight 93, which did not get off the ground for almost an hour, if I recall, and caused all kinds of problems as a result of that. But the other ones succeeded at the same time. Now, mind you, also remember, in my Storming America series, I really love to emphasize the fact that these complex attacks, as one saw October 7th, 2023, from Gaza into Israel, these are going to happen here in the West, somewhere, somehow. As a matter of fact, I think it was a week ago with the publication of this present podcast episode, there was a complex attack in Pakistan that killed 70 people, wounded hundreds more, that took place at the same time at different places. Now, this is not unusual. It is very hard to choreograph, especially from a clandestine perspective. But as I've mentioned before, I do think the cells that I'm talking about today, and I'm not certain what those cellular networks are going to look like once they emerge and how they pulled it off, but if I had to bet money on it, and this particular thing is going to happen here in America or the West, and I don't want to be correct on this, but I do think it's more a matter of when or if we are going to find that this non-traditional model that I'm talking about, exemplified by Al-Qaeda, will probably inform the command and control and the evidentiary structure of how they will pull this off. As I mentioned, the core group is a ring, and you'll see this in the show notes. I urge you to take a look at the Al-Qaeda training manual. One of the things about an audio podcast is I can't put up charts, graphs, write on a whiteboard or do anything like that. Maybe sometime in the future, once I find somebody who will, give me that contract where they'll provide me with the studio and provide me with the means to do that, I'll be able to improve the way I deliver this to my audience. But in this audio podcast, urge you to look at the show notes and look at the links that I provided you. So the cells of the structure are built outwards from an internal leadership core. Picture a circle within a circle within a circle, a ring within a ring. The core group is a ring superimposed on an inner hub and spoke structure of ideological authority, or in this case, command authority. Each member of the core forms another hub and spoke system. Those spokes leading to the infrastructure cells under the supervision of the core group member and possibly to operational groups that the headquarters supports. In an organization like this, there's a point at which the operational cell becomes autonomous of the core, and members surviving the operation may rejoin at various points, but riffing off of what Schlichter and Fortune said in their books, I think that if this event comes off the way I suppose that it will, they're not expecting survivors. Now, UBL, Osama bin Laden in this model, had the responsibility of commanding the organization and being the spokesman on propaganda messages distributed by the propaganda cell. The other members of the core each command one or more infrastructure cells. Why propaganda? Because of narrative. And don't think for a moment that just because UBL is dead, that Al-Qaeda is dead, or some kind of adjacent or copycat organization hasn't risen up to do the very things that he did. Now, we have infrastructure cells. And so, especially non-traditional ones, they're going to need a variety of technical and administrative functions fulfilled. It's everything from recruitment and training, forged documents, counterfeit currency, to safe houses, the operational plan that takes place, how to pre-position arms and ammunition, the psychological operations that have to take place. For instance, when those young men in Venice, Florida, just up the street from me, happened to take that training to get ready for the September 11th, 2001 attacks and learn how to fly aircraft, there were a lot of things that had to be put into place to put them in that very position so that they could pay for the training, go to the training, be at the training and not be suspicious, and then, of course, leave with the training and find themselves, along with other groups who had done that, at the very same place on the very same day on September 11th to pull off the simultaneous effect and attack that took place. These are what the infrastructure and auxiliary cells achieve, also operating for the most part in a clandestine environment. And these cellular structures that are administrative or infrastructure can be wholly owned or conjoined to completely above ground legitimate operations as simply a splinter that's bifurcated off of it in a small corner of that organization to support these efforts. So let's take a look. If we take a slice of this and we look at what it's going to do, you'll have different members who are going to be in charge of different things. You'll have someone in charge of finance, military training, transportation, communications and propaganda, i.e. narrative, and those kind of things. But you'll also have, we'll take this example. The leader of a military cell is responsible for training its members, and when an operation is scheduled, selecting the operational commander, giving him the basic objective, arranging whatever support is needed, and then releasing him from tight control to execute. Military leaders might have to direct, possibly one-way communications with their cells, or they might have to give someone the message to be transmitted. Now, in this case, what's going to happen is that as a result of immigration practices in the United States for decades, but especially accelerating in the past 4 years, we've had, and this includes the entirety of the European Union too, you have just literally tens of thousands of single military males, military age males, without families coming into the country. Some disappear, some don't disappear. Some start drawing on welfare under separate identities. Whatever the case may be, once they have breached the border and they are in the country proper that they are going to operate against and eventually get the call to attack one morning or one evening, all that has to happen is this. Let's suppose there are 1,000 men. We're going to make the math easy here because we're doing the math on air. They are divided into 10-man cells which means if it's 1,000 men, and we can do the multiplication as we need to, that means that you're going to have 100 cells in your organizational structure. You make sure that every 10 cells has a leader. So that would mean that you would only have 10 folks in charge, and they would assign a cellular structure so that if a single cell was compromised, it would not fault your strength or debit your strength by very much. And the other ones who are uncompromised, because those cellular leaders don't have within the country itself the identification nor contact and communications with those other cell leaders, they can still proceed with the mission even if some of those 1,000 men are compromised in one fashion or another. I'm convinced that these cellular structures are advanced. I'm convinced that there are non-official covers here from traditional first world nations like the Chinese and the Russians. The NOCs, the non-official covers, are formal intelligence organizations from first world and peer and near peer countries who have folks here that are sleepers, as it were. A sleeper is one that's activated for a specific targeting modality. First world. Now, the thing with first world nations, for the most part, really hard to find these kind of cellular structures that would start a sabotage or killing campaign in America and expect to survive that and be repatriated to their country. That is where the wild card is with Muslim organizations. The Muslim organizations using Al-Qaeda for instance, or even Hezbollah and Hamas, and there are a myriad other ones throughout the world. If you have a cellular structure, if you're in place, if you're weaponized, and the infrastructure has not been compromised in any sense, and then on D-Day, on zero day, when the attacks are launched simultaneously, all you have to do is make a call to the cell leaders who make a call to their respective subordinate cells, and they're fire and forget weapons, because in this case, it seems pretty convincing to me that they are going to launch these attacks until they're killed or captured. And they know, as a result of the religiosity and past methodologies that we've seen, that they will be killed, and there is no organizational construct for repatriating them in the country, out of the country, rat line to their country of origin. These particular Muslim terrorist cells aren't oriented to that. They don't have to do that, which makes this a very tough nut to crack. So I wanted to quote from Hunting the Sleepers, Tracking Al-Qaeda's Covert Operatives. I'll put this in the show notes. I think this was written all the way back in 2001, but I found it very plausible and compelling to include even now, nearly a quarter century later. Quote, operational cells are not created, but instead seeded, utilizing individuals spotted or that request assistance. Both groups are vetted by being trained under the observation of the core group, which dramatically restricts the opportunity for passing off walk-ins under false flag. Notice, dramatically restricts the opportunity for passing off walk-ins under a false flag, such as the FBI's standing operating procedure of trying to penetrate terror organizations in the United States before they conduct their operations. Going on, categorization of operational cells appears to be by capabilities, region, and then task operation. Operational cells are composed of members whose worldview has been firmly tested, necessary to front load, because such cells are dispersed back to their own local control or negative control prescribed behavior, with positive control only coming in the form of contact for synchronization or support. End of quote. Now, you found that there have been traditional indigenous gangs in America, such as the Bloods and the Crips and other ones, and now we have ones coming in to the country under the auspices of MS-13 and all other kinds of Venezuelan, Mexican, and South American derivatives that are coming here. You will note that there's this apocryphal tale that in order for them to be blooded into the gang, they actually have to maim or murder somebody. That isn't done simply as a primitive means to vet them and make sure that they have proven themselves in that fashion. What it proves is they're not feds. What it proves is that they're not working, for the most part, for a national intelligence organization, especially if it is indigenous to the country itself. It proves out that it's a way to weed out possible interference by false flag or inserted members who are trying to bring the organization down. Now, there are also indirect support networks. And again, I'm going to quote from the sleeper cell document that I'll put in the show notes. Quote, while Al-Qaeda had elements of the organization designed to support the structure, but such elements are insufficient in meeting the needs of such an organization, and for security reasons, there would be redundant and secondary tertiary networks that are unaware of their connection to Al-Qaeda. These networks, primarily related to fundraising and financial activities, as well as technology providers, are in a use relationship with Al-Qaeda, managed through cutouts or individuals that do not inform them of the nature of activities and that may have a cover pretext sufficient to deflect questions or inquiry. End of quote. So, in other words, once these cellular structures are instantiated and established and rooted in a given target country, they can reach out through various means to legitimate above-ground entities and either seek or purchase their support with those entities who have provided that, not knowing any better that they have provided for a possible militarized cell that wishes that indigenous country harm. Now, in this document, there are a number of suggestions or conclusions, and I'll highlight some of them that I found of interest. One said, become creative, get ahead of Al-Qaeda, think out of the box, and get external beta teams to augment U.S. thinking. In my mind, sure, but that's not going to happen because the bureaucratic ecology of the U.S. government and Western governments at large does not like red teaming. They do not like contrarian thinking. They do not like anything that violates the groupthink that allows all of these things to continue to occur. They go on to say, Al-Qaeda likes double blinds, damned if you do, damned if you don't, with the risks and consequences considerable either way. Their attack dependency infrastructure of Al-Qaeda, little of which is conventional. So they say, analyze a map, model the Al-Qaeda organization, identify and target official nodes, break off their structural support elements. And then they go on to say, advance defense in depth for the private and governmental sectors. And then they say, costs are well worth considering as mechanisms for increasing the friction and decreasing the efficiency of Al-Qaeda. I don't find any of these useful whatsoever. Here you have this really good document that was produced, and these are the suggestions and conclusions, which of course are speaking to their bureaucratic provider in this case, who wants to hear these kind of answers. And then they said something very interesting. Stability in the Middle East and Islamic regions is essential in limiting the genesis context from which threats are emerging. What they're saying is settle regional issues, a Palestinian state, stabilize Lebanon's and Jordan's economies, encourage Syria and Iran out of isolation, change the approach against Iraq. How interesting. All of those are fascinating and in my mind, facile, because none of them will happen. As long as there is this relationship with Israel, it will forego all of those things happening. And as far as emergent threats and things like that, the U.S. government has the entire West has a very poor track record of examining these things in a sober fashion and coming to conclusions that make political leaders and their concomitant decision makers uncomfortable. When here it said the Palestinian state, that's not going to happen, as we've seen since 2023. Mind you, this was written a quarter century ago. Lebanon and Jordan's economies, we see what's happening with that connection to Israel. Encouraging Syria and Iran out of isolation, we've seen none of that. What we've seen in this past quarter century, a continued effort to take all the Shia nations from Bahrain to Syria to Iran to large parts of Iraq to different areas in which there are Shia concentrations and putting them to the torch. That is not going to discourage these organizations from launching attacks in the West, which are going to cause them a lot of distress. Now, I'm taking a very specific example here in the Middle East of where so many problems could have been predicted. As most of my listeners know from listening to me in these podcasts, if you look at the end of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century, all the seeds for the unrest, disquiet, and warlike nonsense that has gone on in the Middle East all come from what happened when the Ottoman Empire blew apart and settled into the historical dustbin. After that, once the Western nations started dictating map lines with very geometric and straight lines, regardless of tribe, clan, and blood, all of the enmities that had been in these regional conflict complexes, all those embers that I've talked about before, they got a lot of oxygen. And as a result of that, we had this cavalcade of calamities that is U.S. and Western intervention in the Middle East, and now we are reaping the whirlwind. So I want to close out this episode with a really interesting article, which I will put in the show notes, called How They Hunt by Treaded, published on Lizard Farmer. And what he did is he took cellular structures and he said, well, how is a first world nation state going to attack these? Mind you, this is 2013, but I don't think much has changed. So I'm going to quote, make no mistake that over the last decade, in this case, he's talking 2003 to 2013, the DOD, DOJ, DHS, NSA, and CIA have definitely learned their lessons from shortly after 9/11, when the new lessons of counterinsurgency still lay ahead, to the recent last few years, capture and killing of Al-Qaeda's top officers. The concepts and techniques of counterinsurgency targeting have been vastly refined. Lessons learned not only on the battlefield, but in the ops center, have developed intelligence exploitation systems that are genuinely lethal due to their ability to be comprehensive and timely. Instead of sitting there typing out how these systems work, I'm going to throw out a bit of a scenario for you. Not every system is represented, but hopefully I'll depict enough of them to give you an appreciation of just how dangerous they are. So I don't want to use this airtime to talk about the very interesting scenario, very compelling, that he shows to illustrate how all of these intelligence community and law enforcement assets would be employed in the United States to find terror cells. So I want to move to towards the end of the article. He maps out where you find somebody with suspicious activity, and you watch every aspect 24/7 of how they conduct their lives, to the extent where you can have those association matrices that I talked about. You can pick up cell phone traffic. You can look at their pattern of life and establish maybe left of bang to stop them from doing something that would be injurious or harmful to a city, town, county, state, whatever the case may be. He concludes by saying this: these tactics are how insurgencies are broken. They're what enabled the system to put bin Laden down, catch the Sarnafs, which was the Boston bomber, and identify drone strike targets in the Middle East. Networks are deadly to an insurgency. Burn that into your mind. Even operating a meat space can be deadly without the right precautions. All it takes is for one person to use that phone to call or that debit card to pay, and they've been nailed in time and space. Sure, you may be using your regular phone and not your disposable one to call Ma, but you're there and the records show it. And if your battle buddy does something similar, he's fixed at the time and place at will. So now both of you are associated. The key is discipline. When you meet, you go completely off the grid. Completely. No phone use, no debit card use, not in and around the geographic area and time frame you meet. Recon and identify how you could expose yourself. Does a certain route have license plate readers? Then don't use it. Convenience stores. They all have those. Nearby ATM machines, cameras and transaction records. The golden rule at all times, and I mean all times, is to ask yourself, how will what I'm doing at this second expose myself and others to identification? In Bob's case, they started with the corpse with no fingerprints. Bob thought he was doing right by sterilizing himself prior to the attack, but in reality, he left gaping holes everywhere else. That one corpse is what allowed a local insurgency to be broken. The same techniques are used in Afghanistan with significant success, despite the lack of things like financial transaction records. It's used stateside on a daily basis, and all it takes is one sloppy SOB to destroy everything. Whether you're a four-man team, nine-man squad, or distributed cells, everybody has to have complete OPSEC uber alles hammered into them and practice it. And the larger your organization, the more likely someone is going to get sloppy. Discipline and vigilance is the key not only to success, but survival as well. It pays to have rules on who does what, who contacts whom, and who contracts whom, and where and when all of this takes place. And these rules have to be understood and enforced, end of quote. So in this case, what the author is doing is putting himself in the skin suit of a potential or ambitious cell organizer or cell member and saying, these are the things that you have to do. Discipline is going to be a key part of it, but we also have to remember that discipline is going to be a key part of what is happening in the West if my forecast of an upscaled Gaza attack on the U.S. or the West occurs. We will find it beforehand left a bang because of a lack of discipline on cell members or such. Now, there is a vaunted fable out there that the Israeli Defense Forces, for instance, best in the world, not. They haven't successfully won a war since 1973. I would urge all of my readers to take a look at the 2007 Winograd Commission report on the 2006 invasion of Lebanon. Apparently, the Israelis are being silly enough now to want to step up and step off their attacks into Lebanon this year, which will be an unmitigated military disaster for them, is my forecast. But what we see is that October 7th, 2023, we have the attack from Gaza into Israel. Israel having allegedly one of the most protected borders in the world, one of the most vaunted and defense in depth intelligence apparatuses, aided by a diaspora planet-wide of Jewish co-religionists who would help them to predict, if not forecast, the attack that happened. But apparently, the attack was a complete surprise. I mean, here you're talking about a country where you have folks who were well into their old age sitting on lawn chairs with radios and binoculars that they probably provided themselves, but they've tied themselves in with the Israeli government to let them know on the border when strange things are happening. None of that happened. None of the predictive frameworks or forecast frameworks of indicators and warnings in the Israeli or greater Western and American intelligence organizations, whether technical intelligence or human intelligence, gave them a glimpse or even a flicker that this was going to happen on October 7th, 2023. We have to remember that these bad actors, as characterized by those who would say that an invasion of Israel was wrong and a concomitant upscaled invasion simultaneously in America would be wrong, these are learning organisms. They know what to do. They know what not to do. Otherwise, for instance, in 2001, when 9/11 occurred, they would have been isolated and stopped well before that happened. Same thing applies for the embassy bombings in 1998. Same thing applies for the 1994-95 New York City bombings that took place. And any number of other things. What you find is that organizationally, the larger the Western bureaucracies become, the more resistant they are to red teaming, to contrarian thinking, to taking into consideration possibilities that make them uncomfortable or may not conform or shoehorn into their particular worldview of who can do ill and who can't do ill and who would you suspect and who wouldn't you suspect. I want to leave you with this. And mind you, in the show notes, I provided all the background reading for a lot of what I've highlighted today. Cell structures are real. Cell structures improve. And for those practiced militants out there on Earth who wish to do you harm, no matter what country it may be, even in the advanced first world nations of America and Western Europe, this can happen, and it can happen in a big way. It just happened a mere 9 months ago in Israel, and it can happen in America. You've been warned. Prepare accordingly. This is Bill, out.